Chapter 5 Mercy and Weakness. Jen didn't sleep. He sat hands around knees in a stand of golden maple trees to the side of the church and waited until everyone straggled out of the square and the lamps in nearby buildings winked out. Jen watched as the Scholzes left the Morwalds and went home, where they stayed awake for nearly an hour before going to sleep. He watched as Pure Man Millersham and Raphael came out of the same door carrying a basin and a large wooden box of herbs that the Pure Man used for the healing of the sick and injured. Still he waited, shivering in the autumn chill. Although the wind had died down, the clouds persisted, covering the moons, shards and stars, creating perfect darkness. When the Pure Man extinguished the lamps inside the church, Jen paused a few more minutes and determined it was time to put his plan into motion. Convenient to the back of the church was a small outbuilding where the Pure Man stored various implements used for gardening and interring the dead. The door squeaked wildly as Jen opened it, but he hurriedly picked out two spades he knew leaned against the wall within easy reach. As stealthily as he could, he sneaked slowly across the benighted churchyard with spades in hand, trying to remember where everything was. A soft orange glow on the back steps of the church set his heart to racing, and he threw himself prone, worried that someone had spotted him. The spades clattered loudly when they hit the ground, destroying whatever stealth he had hoped for.
"Get up, lad, and come here," Raphael ordered. "You're going to kill yourself bumbling around like that in this blackness."
Jen stood up sheepishly, swiping the damp leaves off his pants and shirt. As he came closer to the church, he could make out Raphael and Pure Man Millersham quietly sharing a pipe on the rear steps. Jen was glad he couldn't see the Pure Man clearly, fearing what those blue eyes might say about what he was doing.
"Good evening, Pure Man," Jen said softly, desperately hoping Millersham wouldn't notice the shovels lying on the ground behind him. "How is Regina?"
Millersham inhaled deeply, savoring the smoke before handing the pipe back to Raphael. Pipeweed would not grow in Tell, but the Pure Man and Raphael ensured that the Morwalds ordered some from the south every autumn.
"She will live," Pure Man Millersham reported. "It took time, twineweed and a lot of prayer, but she finally awoke before we left. A bad wound, that one, but she is strong and will be back to herself soon." "Were it not for you, Pure Man," Raphael said, "she likely wouldn't have lived through the night. You do good work." "I do as Elderloth wills, that is all."
He savoured the smoke for a moment, smacking his lips.
"The tobacco crop doesn't seem as rich as last year's, Master Bard. What do you think?" "It was a dry spring. Let me have another turn at it."
"At least," Jen broke in, "old Billy put the betrothal off for a few more days. Why didn't they wait until spring? That's the tradition."
Neither man spoke for a long time.
"I'm afraid, Jen," Millersham finally admitted, "that the Scholzes ordered me to perform the betrothal as soon as she woke up, though I objected. They will be married come spring. As to why, I think as a capstone to the celebration, and because Hubert will leave soon after their marriage to go back to the army. You might get pressed into it too if Ogmir attacks and things go poorly. I'm sorry it happened this way, Jen, but Bernard is the magistrate."
Jen felt sadness and anger well up within him anew.
"How could you?" he protested. "It's bad enough there to be wed at all, not to mention the lack of dignity or concern shown by forcing her into the betrothal when she's half conscious and bleeding all over the place."
Pure Man retrieved the pipe from Raphael.
"I agree with you, but make no mistake. Bernard can make plenty of trouble for me, and the two would be betrothed whether I performed the rite tonight, or 2 weeks from now, or in the spring. There is little difference. Perhaps it turned out better this way. Some things are better born half-conscious."
"I would think,"
Jen countered, getting angrier at Millersham's cavalier attitude,
"that if Regina had the choice of being betrothed to that monster for 2 weeks fewer, she would take it. What an utter mockery of decency. This is all—"
"It appears you have some digging to do, Jan," Raphael cut in, a voice stern but sympathetic. "You'd best be about it."
Jen expected a rebuke from the Pure Man, for undoubtedly he guessed what Jen was about. Instead, Pure Man Millersham simply said,
"Good luck, Jen, and don't get caught. Be assured that our thoughts go with you, even when our hands cannot."
Jen turned from the two men, gathered the spades and ran across the square as fast as he could, holding one spade in each hand to keep them from banging together. As quickly as he could safely and quietly manage, he ran up the small incline to the left of the Schulz's home and into a thicket. Gant waited for him underneath a tall ash, which was pushing up through the centre of more diminutive trees. Before them, some 20 feet from the rear of the Schulz's house, was the outhouse. It was almost invisible in the darkness, but the stink was unmistakable.
"You sure you want to go through with all this, Jen?" Gant whispered. "This could mean real trouble. I mean real trouble. I know you like the girl and all. It has to be done. If you want to leave, then do. I'll manage."
Gant stood silent and still for several moments, and Jen thought that he might just turn and go. Gant was usually the first to cause trouble, but his apprenticeship had mellowed the mischievousness of the young man, and Yurl brooked no boyishness. Still, Gant hated the Schulzes, and Jen wondered whether the hatred or the thought of Yurl scolding him would win out.
"Let's be quick about it," Gant finally acquiesced. "We got work to do in the morning. You layabout bards don't know what that's like."
Jen patted his friend's back and they approached the outhouse slowly, listening for any sign that the Schulzes were awake. After a few minutes of listening to Bernard, or perhaps Hubert, snore loudly enough to scare away birds, they set about their work. Although no one had ever done it before, what Jen proposed to do to the outhouse was really a simple alteration. First, he and Gant edged the structure backwards until the waste pit was exposed. Breathing through their mouths to prevent the smell from overcoming them, they dug around the pit, creating a sloped funnel that descended into it. Damp ground made for quiet digging. That done, and the dark dirt piled away behind the thicket, they moved the entryway of the outhouse over the new hole. The next Schulz to visit the outhouse would find himself sliding down until he was armpit deep in his own filth.
"Thank you for your help, Gant. You gonna wait?"
"Yes, I need to see this," Jen replied.
"Well, I'm not crazy. If you get caught, you'll find yourself banished from Tell. You be careful, Jen. You stand to lose a lot if Bernard catches you."
"I know, Gant. But how can I stay in this town season after season, year after year, and watch her with that buffoon? I have to leave here, and whether I'm forced to or choose to, it makes little difference now. But don't worry, Gant. If I'm caught, I'll leave you out of it. You and Yurl will have a happy life. Take the spades back."
"There will be another girl, Jen. You've got to believe that."
Jen answered nothing, and Gant jogged into the night, leaving him to his crude, cruel vigil. At first, the anger and anticipation kept him awake, but as the night wore on, the rough emotions lost their edge and turned from ardent hate to empty coldness. It rained lightly, on and off. While the trees above him protected him from the wetness, the soft pattering of the rain on the leaves and ground soothed and dampened the hurt within him. Jen felt that nature wept with him in the dark, and knowing that someone or something shared his pain, unclenched his nerves, and subdued his nagging headache. Several times he considered undoing his trap, replacing the dirt and walking away, but just when he would decide to do it, the image of Regina lying bleeding on the stones of the square returned to his mind, shoring up his resolve. He needed something more than just the comfort of the rain and the trees. Deep inside his heart, something demanded justice, and barring that, retribution. Justice in a town controlled by the Schulzes was impossible. Justice would be Regina, betrothed to someone she could share her heart with, someone like Jen. Justice would have the entire Schulz family carted away and left in the reed steps to live or die, far from the company of decent folk. Pure Man Millersham taught, however, that in the fallen, shattered world of Keyhall, good and right were not always followed or rewarded, and evil was not always shunned and punished. The Church urged the people not to seek their own justice when the men of the world failed, but rather to be humble and to pray for deliverance from grudges and hatred. Revenge, it was said, was Mikik's tool to destroy souls and spread violence and sorrow. But Jen knew there were limits to how much should be tolerated in the name of humility and faith, for history abounded with stories of those who refused to live with injustice any longer. History counted them heroes. Ignati, a prelate of the church itself, turned against his religious superiors when he saw corruption and vice in them, leading the fighting orders in a 5-year-long war against the church and the nations that would follow it. His action in the face of injustice earned him the adoration of church leaders in the years afterward. What would have happened if he had sat in his monastery chamber and only prayed for deliverance or hoped that justice would eventually prevail? While Jen had no delusions that his cause was nearly as grand as that of Ignati, he hoped the same principle applied to his predicament. But the more he thought about it, the more he realized just how rabid and unthinking he let himself become in the hours after hearing of the betrothal. Jen remembered Ignati's letter to the pontiff, announcing his intentions to rid the church of corruption. The man was deeply sorrowful about what he felt he had to do, and his mind was clear, far different from the wild passions that pulsed through Jen earlier that evening, passions that were ebbing as fatigue gained a foothold upon him. A couple hours before dawn, the clouds began to break up, and the soft light from the moons Min and Duum illuminated the small clearing where the rigged outhouse sat. The moon, Triss, eclipsed, was an abyss ringed with light. Two moons set against the one, a symbol of the Shalane and the Ha'ulric standing fast against the murdering purposes of Mikik.
"It will be a great war," Father Milosham preached. "Most of us will not stand in battlefields against the enemy. Most of us must win the war only in our hearts and in our homes. While we will wield no sword, we must wield forgiveness. We wear no armor, but clothe ourselves in kindness. We spill no blood, but we just as surely strike the heart of evil with every wound we bind, with every tear we shed in sympathy, and with every smile with which we lift the spirit of another."
With a sigh, Jen looked at the Scholes' house and then back through the trees where he could barely make out the window where he knew Regina slept. Something broke within him, and tears fell from his eyes and onto the ground. He did not let the feeling engulf him and would not let himself sob or wail. The sadness drained from him in silence, and after a few minutes he wiped his face, cursing Raphael for teaching him introspection. He got up and took a step toward the church to retrieve a spade. There was little time to undo what they had done, if it could be undone at all.
"You are weak. It should not be so."
The voice came from within his own head, but squinting into the moonlight, he could see the figure of a girl, no more than 6 or 7, standing just outside the line of trees. The light from the moons did not illuminate her, but instead cast her as a black silhouette against a dim backdrop, almost as if his mind projected a shadow untouched by the world around it. Jen wanted to walk forward to see if she were real or a figment of his imagination, but found he couldn't move. Something about the voice seemed familiar, but only faintly so. It was not the voice of a child.
"You want the woman, so why do you not take her? Why do you defer to idiots and dullards? You should kill the boy and take the woman. You do not yet realize your station. Instead, you sit and weep and let things pass as they are. Let the world drift by without your mark. I teach you and return to find you wandering ever further from the path set before you. Time grows ever shorter, and you are a poor tool indeed."
What she spoke was not in the common tongue, but Jen somehow understood it. His mind raced. This had happened before, but he couldn't remember it clearly. Every time his mind would find the memory, it slid away. The figure chiding him, half seen and unknowable, wanted him to do something, to learn something. Jen knew this, but he couldn't retrieve a single lesson or instruction. The apparition demanded obedience, was desperate for him to accomplish something, but with no commandment he could recall, Jen found nothing to obey.
"You have resisted me for too long, and it must end. You are without mother. You are without father. What you are, you owe to me. It took 3 years to find you after they stole you from me. 3 years, and the damage done is indeed great. Tell has made you soft and unsuited for your destiny. The world needs to tremble with fear, and you dally. But your time for play has ended. You may not serve as you should, but you will. The power is in you, waiting with Triss to be born. Against that day I have given you knowledge and instruction, but you do nothing with it. Prepare now, Jen. Tonight I set you on a path to repentance.
The figure dissolved into the night. The force that held him released, and he fell to the ground gasping for air. With effort, he scooted up against a tree and sat for several minutes, quite unconscious of anything. A raven landed on the branch above him, startling him from his stupor. He felt dizzy for a moment and closed his eyes. When he opened them again, he found himself prone on the dirt. With effort, he composed himself. What had happened? Someone talked to him, but the memory slipped away. Startled, he realized the morning sun already paled the night sky, and the trap still awaited a victim. Breathing deeply and shaking his head to clear it, Jen stood. As he took his first step, he caught movement in the corner of his eye and turned to see if he had been discovered. Men moved carefully between the bowls to his left, slowly stepping toward the back of the Scholes' house. He counted 5, with swords drawn, blades reflecting the shaft's moonlight. They wore cloaks and moved carefully, knees bent for silent walking. Jen wondered if they might be thieves coming out of the wood to steal supplies for the winter, something that occurred every few years. A dog barked and they stopped, standing as still as the trees, the man at the head raising his hand in a signal to wait. Their unity and weapons made Jen doubt they were mere brigands, though he couldn't imagine who else would take an interest in such a small town. Abruptly, the barking ceased with a yelp. As one, the 5 sprinted forward and with brutal efficiency shattered the Scholes' back door, pouring inside. Jen's chest tightened, heart hammering. Screams erupted from the house and echoed into the night. Throughout the town arose a cacophony of surprise and terror. Women and men yelled in alarm. Children cried. Dogs barked and were silenced. Jen thought quickly. The house where he and Raphael lived was but a short walk from town down the main road. If the men were attacking the center of town, perhaps they had ignored the outlying farms and houses. If he could manage it, he could warn others to flee and press on to Baron Forthrickshire to get help. Jen came to a crouch. The noise inside the Scholes' house subsided to whimpering and crying. He looked back toward the city center. Someone had lit a lamp in Regina's room, casting a silhouette against the window. His heart took a blow as he thought of what might be happening to her, and without further consideration of his initial plan, he ran from underneath the ash tree toward the back door of the store. He knew the terrain well, but his feet still tripped on deadfall and rocks he could have avoided easily in the light. Within a few seconds, he leapt up the 4 back steps and pushed the door open. The storeroom had no windows, and while he knew roughly how the Morwolds arranged their goods, he had to walk blindly and slowly, feeling the shelves and sacks of grain as he made his way to the door that led to the storefront. Heavy boots thudded above him, creaking the boards, Regina's father shouting for the men to leave them alone. Frantically, Jen felt for the door, and at last his fingers grasped the handle, but the sound of footsteps on the floorboards pulled him up short. Rushing headlong into a dark room to face men with swords would certainly gain him nothing, and would likely cost him his life. Moving carefully, Jen put his ear to the door, listening for any signs of what might be happening. Whoever was in the store either wasn't moving or had left. George stopped yelling. Regina's younger sister wailed loudly, and Regina's mother was crying and begging the unknown attackers not to hurt them. Jen's rage strove with his fear, but a realization of his powerlessness weakened his resolve. While the woodsmen and their axes might put up a crude defense, only 3 people in Tell had proper training to fight. Sykes, the warden, the huntmaster, and possibly Hubert. Jen cursed. All he knew how to do was talk, sing, and play the lute, none of which would help him against armed men. Footsteps on the stairs turned his attention back to his listening. The crying continued, but there were other voices.
Shut up, woman! Just get to the church! If you don't stop that racket, I will hurt her! Tarrant, did you check back there?
At least they're not just killing everyone, Jen thought, feeling a little comfort. A creak on the boards behind the door made him realize that, back there was probably where he was standing. He tried to step back, but found that he couldn't move or breathe. While he couldn't see anything, Jen could feel her, feel the will and the power just behind him. Disdain and disapproval emanated from the blackness, flooding Jen with feelings of guilt.
Now you understand your weakness. If you would have but listened to me through these years, you could have saved this town, though it is worth nothing. I told you this attack was coming, and you could have saved them all. They would have worshipped you and given you whatever you wanted, including the girl. Now people will die. But not you. You will learn. Remember the pain, boy. Remember you could have prevented it. You could have used this night to rise from obscurity.
Jen wanted to turn, wanted to face his accuser. How could he possibly have prevented this? How could he be accused of not listening when every memory of the encounters meant to teach him faded into nothingness? He struggled to turn, to move his feet and hide. Boards creaked nearer and nearer the door. A hand worked the lock, and still Jen could not move. The door burst open, slamming Jen backward. With no power over his limbs, he was unable to brace himself for the impact against the shelving. The back of his skull hit something hard, his vision sparking and blurring. Helplessly, he slumped to the floor as items from the toppling shelf, and then the shelf itself, fell on top of him. Dimly, he was aware of someone leaning over him. He struggled to get up, but his head swooned, and everything faded away.